This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, it's time to catch up with one of my favorite comedians, one of South Africa's most celebrated people in terms of not only his comedy career, but most recently acting and movies and everything else, and the fact that he saves lives in his spare time.
Oh, my goodness, really? I do not save lives anymore. I do not remember medicine.
You did, Dr. Riyad Musa. How are you?
I'm very well.
It's nice to see you, man.
Yeah, nice to see you, too. I don't remember any medicine.
No,
always say... like in my shows, you know, if someone, you know, is choking on a whisper and they go,
is there a doctor?
No. I could spring to action and entertain you as you slowly pass away. That's the extent of my ability. I'm going to tell you a joke before you die. I'm actually trying to do some sort of health promotion these days.
Yeah.
So, you know, to merge, because for long, I never planned not to do medicine. It's just sort of, you know, I was doing comedy at the same time as medicine, and opportunities open up with the comedy, and I followed the path of least resistance, and I found myself doing what I'm doing now. But I still have a yearning to do some sort of medicine. But it's like, it's counterintuitive to like, now I want to open a practice. It doesn't make sense, you know?
And also, you know how hard that is. Yes, I mean, it's
a business in itself.
Yes.
So what I'd like to do is like collate the two and try and create... funny medical like videos and things like
that. Why don't you open up a YouTube channel where you kind of explain to kids what the different organs do, but you make it funny?
Yes.
I'm doing
a little bit, and I have actually started on doing little videos like that.
That would be hilarious. I'd love to see them.
Yeah. I'm experimenting a lot. So it's a mixture between animation, magic, little sketches. But it's all in a sort of experimentation phase, because the issue is when you merge comedy with things, comedy subversive.
Yeah.
So I don't want to take the main thing is the education.
Right.
So, but when you add too much comedy to it,
people don't know to take it seriously, the
message is. So that's finding that balance. I'll only get that through experimentation.
Yeah, because it's more of a style thing than a content thing. Right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
And comedy has a style, even if you're not going to be subversive in the content, you can be funny about the way you tell these things.
Yes, yes, yes.
Listen, I mean, you're such a multi-talented guy. Don't you hate it when people box you into one category? I mean, this has become almost like it's almost like my own... mission is to just remind people that all these words and all these boxes that we use to put people in are ill-fitting, uncomfortable.
Yes.
Individuals don't want to be put into them.
Yes.
Most of us don't like being categorized.
Yes.
Because we know we're a bunch of contradictions.
Yes.
We're a bunch of different interests.
Yes.
I mean, look at you, for example. From, I've got to tell you, because I haven't seen you since then, your portrayal of Ahmed Kathrada was... first class.
Thank you.
And I know it wasn't a major part of the script, but man, you brought power to that role. And we all know what an influence that man had on our politics in South Africa. Well done. It was just beautiful to
see. Thank you. And it's a huge inspiration for me and a huge honor for me to actually portray Mr. K, Uncle Kathy.
Uncle Kathy.
And there was a lot of sort of, introspection about like what sacrifice actually meant for me, because I was the same age as he was when you were sentenced to life in prison, 35 when we filmed it.
Wow.
5 years ago. So I remember thinking about that when we were on a trip on our way to Robben Island, and we shot a lot of things in Robben Island. He went to Robben Island, sentenced to life imprisonment when he was 35, right? And I was thinking about that on the trip home. You know, he only got out when he was 60. Right? And he wasn't supposed to get out because life imprisonment then meant life imprisonment. So it was a thing. And, you know, you miss a whole era. Because I asked him, how did he feel when he was released, when they told him he was going to be released? So he was like, they got a call from the head of the prison, and he said he just received a fax from prison headquarters, and we are going to be released tomorrow. And my first question was, what is a fax?
Jeez.
Right?
Well, there's that old joke. I still don't know whether it's true or not, because there were only two people in the story, and maybe it's been one of those that's been added on to Broken Telephone. Mm. But when Mandela got out of prison and Winnie cooked him a chicken in the microwave.
Yes.
And he saw it and he said, "Ah, Winnie, why is this TV only showing a chicken?"
No, I believe that.
Yeah, dude, because cell phones.
Yes.
Those, you know, if you'd gone into jail or you'd gone into a coma in 1990.
Yes.
And woken up in 2008.
Yeah.
These things, these cell phones, people would have gone, "Nah, that's not possible, man. That's crazy. That's like sci-fi."
It's crazy. And we're entering an era of exponential change.
Right.
So everything is going to change very quickly, quicker than we can anticipate, as you know.
Well, you do too. This is why we've got to be, you said, path of least resistance,
yes.
Be open to change,
yes.
Take opportunities as they come to you.
Exactly.
That's how brilliant people are going to do things in the next couple of years. Otherwise, if you have an idea and you're not accessible to outcomes that might be different,
you just gotta fail.
You
got to flow, and that's where it's very challenging.
But I want to get to this whole thing about Katrada in a little while, because I do think that there's probably a lot of introspection you can share with us all in terms of what you, because it must have gone through your head over, when you're doing a role like that, you can't treat it without gravity.
Yes.
So, and you're a thoughtful guy, and you're also behind the scenes a bit of a nerd. You must have done huge amounts of research. You must have spoken to him as much as you possibly could. So I want to know about that.
Yeah.
Because that's how a serious actor takes his... And I mean, you didn't know you were going to be an actor when you were studying medicine. you didn't know this when you were doing comedy even.
I didn't.
So I want to get into that. But first, back to my point about being so many things in so many ways. I mean, do you often feel that people ask you which one's the real you, but you're all of them?
Yes.
And it frustrates you?
Yes. The difficulty for me is creating authenticity and being able to express every facet of your being, right, honestly, in an artistic way. That's very challenging. Now, with social media and with people having access to you, you are able to do it a little bit more. And people can get a feel for who you are if you are willing to expose yourself more than in the past.
But they can also take something out of context and make it look like you are one-dimensional.
Exactly.
And choose something that perhaps is not your finest moment.
That's the reaction to it, yes.
Yeah.
I completely agree.
So it's it's like a double-edged sword,
it's
right?
It's very challenging. Very challenging because people consume things in bites and small little bits, whereas like we are so much more. So for me is like I actually trying to get to a place where I can have like a singular or like a very authentic idea. So for example, my show, Life Begins, I've tried to be more honest than I ever have before. So in the sense, in the beginning, when we started comedy, because everything was new, you could talk about general things, politics, sort of general racial stereotypes, a lot more than you can now, because then it wasn't hack. Then
It was revolutionary. It was people opening up, talking honestly.
Yes.
Now that stuff is almost regarded as being politically incorrect.
Yes, and also everybody's doing it, so it's hackneyed. So the only way in which you can be unique, completely unique, is to go within and express your personal life and your personal opinions and views in as honest a way as possible, and trying to reveal a little bit more of yourself on stage. And people do that to set themselves apart. So at the end of a show, people will know you. Because so many people, they super hilarious. So you will have a sore belly after a show, but you don't know them.
Mm.
And then there are other comedians other artists when you actually know the person after the show. And those are the people that actually stick with audiences.
So are you digging that deep now on this show?
More so. Not completely, but I mean more so. And you see it as a trend in the world. And it's happened sort of independently. So these things are happening. Like if I think Life Begins, I started doing that, right? But then you watch a lot of other shows, like that you've seen a lot of shows on Netflix. And for example, most recently,
Chris
Rock's special. Yeah. Very, very personal, you know?
And Chappelle's.
And Chappelle's as well.
Well, Chris Rock, I mean, there's a lot of talk around the things he spoke about with regard to his own divorce in that show. And and there's a mixed reaction, you know. People aren't sure how to take it because, again, comedy is so subversive.
Yes.
Is he being honest or is he amping it up for laughs?
Well, I mean, you can...
You know, it's a tough thing if you're not a comedian, you sometimes just take something at face value. Okay, so what he's saying is true, but it is also hilarious.
Yes.
Other people will say, I don't know that he's telling the truth, which is an odd way to go about watching a comedy show, but some people do that. And then others will say, no, what he's saying is true, but it shouldn't be said.
Yes, some people don't. It's like people want to watch, people get a lot from art.
Yeah.
Like, because they watch a lot of art, so they know what is different and what is new. And other people just want to watch for escapism. Because they just want they don't want serious.
It's like watching it's watching a sci-fi movie or an action movie.
Yes, they want more escapism, and then the other people who just want the authenticity. And like, I think authenticity has not become hackneyed yet, but it will be because that it's working, and everybody will do that.
The advertising agencies will climb on board.
Yes,
but social media is a bit like that too already.
Yeah.
You can tell. Like some people go on to be real. Some people go on to be popular.
Mm.
And the two aren't always the same thing.
That's not the same.
Sometimes the more real you are, the less popular you are, yes. and vice versa.
It gets very confusing. It gets very confusing.
And for you, do you see social media as just a marketing tool?
Yes.
Yeah, you're not attached to it.
No.
Yeah,
but,
me too.
But I'm trying to do it. I've been thinking about it. Do I push things out? Do I go for quality or quantity? How do I want to live my life? Because I've got four children.
Yeah.
Four. So that's exponential growth in chaos. We're talking about it. You have one and they are as a ball of chaos already. Now you have the second one and you deal with the first one and the second one, but also the reaction between the interaction between the two. And then there's another one and there's a dynamic between all three. And then
so this is exponential change as well.
Exactly.
Because they can all impact butterfly effect on each other. And before you know it, you've got a shit storm in your house.
It's crazy. It's just it's mind boggling. So what
did you want four? Tell the truth.
That is like the first thing my mother said to us when we told her. Was it planned? Like, oh, thank you, mom. That's I expected you to say, oh, my fourth grandchild. Oh. No, was it planned? Okay, yeah.
What is the age range?
So I've got a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 4-week-old.
Yo.
Was very hairy. I was saying, very hairy.
Hairy?
Yeah, unusually hairy. Well, when he came out, he was unusually hairy. For a moment, I was telling people I suspected my wife had an affair with Chewbacca. I was like, it's unusually hairy child. I was scared.
Is it a boy or a girl?
The cry of a boy for
thank
the first
God.
Time.
If it was a girl that was hairy, can you imagine how much worse that would be? That would be terrible.
But then he lost all the hair. All right, soon.
But that happens sometimes, right?
Except for his sideburns.
Elvis's kid.
Yes. He makes a poo and is like, thank you very much. It's weird.
But hang on. This is interesting because there's a thing that happens. No. Because we obviously, you're a doctor, you understand evolution and all the rest of it. There is a situation in the womb where every child grows a coat of hair and sheds it.
Yes.
And usually it happens in the womb. Sometimes it happens after birth.
Mm.
So that's interesting, because
yes.
Then you must have like been shocked when you saw the kid, and then after he lost all the hair, you were like, whew, right?
Actually, it's just like, for me, I just go with it, you know? I like.
So if he'd ended up being hairy forever, you would have still loved him.
You know, I think so, just you know, as I'm combing his mane.
My little boy Sasquatch.
Save money on coats, you know?
Be warm in the winter. Oh my God. All right. So that's a hell of an age range, huh? 10 years old, right down.
Yeah. So, for example, it was. So I use them a lot in social media.
I hope you kept all the baby stuff from the 10 and the 8-year-old.
Yes, we did. We do.
Thank goodness. Because to buy that stuff,
I kept
again,
it, but my wife wants new stuff. So we just buy new stuff all the time.
So now you have to work extra. Four kids. That's a costly exercise.
That's
man.
Heavy, dude. But the idea is I monetize
just the house.
Them.
So you're going to make them share rooms?
Yes. Yeah. But I monetize them.
Yes,
that's my idea.
How do you do that?
You know, if this was China, they'd be in a Reebok factory right now.
Right now, with their little hands.
Yeah, I'm no problem. Right? So I utilize the kids.
It's like you in material.
Yeah, in my stand-up. Like, so for example, for marketing. Okay. Like, so they're good behind the camera, or they're good on. I ask them to do certain things, and they do it.
Okay.
And I use the cute factor to sell shows.
Brilliant.
Right.
And good move.
I'm fine with that. Yeah, I like it's okay. Some people say I'm exploiting my children.
They're your kids.
That's fine.
It's you made them.
Yeah, exactly. So I do that at times. But it's I'm really trying to. I need to optimize things. So I'm really. In terms of social media, I can't be consumed by it because what happens is you become reactive.
Yeah,
you're supposed to control, but social media is so powerful, you become reactive
and so fast moving. You think you've got it under control, and then you blink for a second and you see a feed that's turned into a whirlpool.
Yes, and they say now you go true creativity is when you can step outside and sort of create. Something authentic.
Mm-hmm.
So you either I haven't figured out the balance yet, but I just know because I try to stop social media for not stop it, but I mean, as opposed to going for posting regularly and stuff, I take a step back and try and post something that is of better quality or more unique. But I'm playing around. All of this is the experiment.
But then I can see you kind of agonizing about should I tweet this? Shouldn't I?
Yes.
But there are people who put bullshit out there and get huge responses. I mean, I still can't believe we live in an era where someone can be famous for the curve of her backside and take endless pictures of just her backside and become so powerful that she can affect the stock price of companies like Snapchat. That it boggles my mind. Like you and I sit here and we, should I tweet this? Shouldn't I tweet that? Do I promote this? Don't I let me create something authentic. And some chick is taking a selfie of her ass and getting ahead of everyone.
But that's very authentic. Maybe it is. Very authentic.
But it drives me mad. It must drive you crazy. It must. It must.
Did you watch Ricky Gervais's
special? Oh, I believe. No, I've got it. I'm ready to watch it. I'm going to watch it this weekend.
For you specifically in terms of also, because I think there's a lot of synergy in the way in which you think about things and Gervais, it's great.
Okay.
It's also you enjoyed more it. Honest. It's also more honest. Okay. Gervais is amazing. Okay. Right? It's like it's a bit irritating because he only started doing comedy when he was like stand-up comedy later on, and he did it better than most people.
I saw him live in New York, not on a comedy show, stand-up show. I saw him on what's that singer, Harry Connick Jr. I saw him in Harry Connick Jr.'s show. We were there for a live recording.
Yeah, yeah.
He said something so interesting that made me feel better, and maybe you feel this way too because your show is called Life Begins, right? Mm. So it's 40 years old. Yeah. He said he only really achieved success after 40.
40, yeah.
So does that make you feel good or does that make you feel like you're under pressure?
No, in actual fact, I think I manufacture my own my story. Like, for example, the reason why it's called Life Begins is meaning because I'm making a psychological declaration to the world that I'm only getting started. I'm saying that. So, and at the same...
Is this some kind of metaphysical thing?
I do those things.
Okay.
So I go like, I'm putting this, I'm only getting started.
Right. Telling the universe this is about to happen.
Yes,
get ready.
This, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm still out there. The poster is my head and the body of a baby. Now, there's two pronged is that, you know, I still feel like I'm crawling at 40. I thought I would understand the world more. When in actual fact, I don't understand it less.
Yeah, but here's the irony of saying that. Saying that and acknowledging how little you know is the first step to wisdom.
Exactly.
So this is good.
So you know less, right? So
because at 20, you would have said, I know everything I need to know.
Yes. So, and also you realize... that it's a process. It's not because when I see, like for example, I look at Chris Rock, right? Chris Rock has got like many classic comedy specials, but then you see him in interviews, and he's got the same internal conflict that I have. Like he goes like to comedy clubs, and he puts himself against the younger comedians, sees if he's still relevant, see if he can still play at a high level. It's so interesting. Why would a person that has so much and achieved so much still be so fragile internally?
That's that black hole he's trying to feed.
Yes.
That applause black hole.
Yes.
You know the one.
Yes.
I know the one.
Now, on one hand, I think it's positive.
It's about challenging yourself and improving.
No, in a sense, from a spiritual perspective.
Okay, tell me about how you understand that.
Because your ego can't grow in stand-up as much as it can grow in other fields. So, for example, you go as a musician, a old song can last forever. So a person can sell nostalgia.
Like comedy, you're only as good as your last show.
In my job, I get applause for walk. Like I enter my job. Imagine you walk like into the office. Maybe you get this.
Nobody
and
applauds.
People applaud.
Please, I've been doing this such a long time.
Like
nobody
so
applauds.
Many people, you walk into your office, and this is how your job begins.
Imagine,
right?
Yeah.
So you can't be a. This is not normal. This is not real.
Correct.
Everybody must be effed up. These guys are like any performer,
screwed in the head.
Right?
Sure.
And you get messed up by that platform.
Right.
So with comedy, you a joke doesn't last. So if you constantly put yourself out there, you back down. You have to bring yourself back down.
So it's humbling.
So it's humbling, and that's good for your ego. Because a lot of people who achieve a lot of success and they ride on past successes, when all of a sudden the adulation disappears, they don't know how to deal with it. They have no idea how to deal with it because it's not gone, and what they think is real is not real. So from comedy as an art form, people are protected from that. Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, Dave Chappelle, all of them will go to the little dingy comedy club, the Cellar.
Yeah, they will. They like, do this.
In what other art form do we playing arenas? They do 10,000
You're not going to see Madonna going to do a little club gig.
No.
You're not going to see Justin Bieber pitch up at some sidewalk cafe and start crooning.
No. But the stand-up comedians, it's part of the way. The people who love comedy, primarily comedy.
Yeah.
The true stand-ups, they always do that. So,
so that's part of the conflict. What's the other part of it?
This
challenging yourself, going out there, doing that. You said
So I see that
see
in comedians. So I go like, must I build things up, or like these outcomes, must I focus on these outcomes as much as I do, as rather focus on the process of it? If I'm comfortable in the process of it, all right, and I understand that I want to grow, and I achieve growth, then I'm okay, right? But understand that I may not ever get to where I specifically want to be, and then exhale, like so then it will adjust how fast I go for it, and I can live happier and in a more balanced way.
So let me understand this
unless part. I'm going for, because like if I say, okay, I need to do this now, I need to do this now, I need to do this by,
because
then,
you have to have those things as well.
You need to have that.
Okay, look, you've had massive stand-up comedy success. I mean, you've been part of legendary shows in South Africa that have broken records, raised money for charity, pulled sellout crowds, all that kind of thing. You had to set those goals somewhere.
Yes.
You had to decide, this is the outcome I want. And sometimes that outcome can be limiting, but in these cases that I'm mentioning now, they were extraordinarily, exponentially a growth opportunity.
Yes, yes.
You've done movies. Mm. Again, this is not in the normal realm of things, but you decided this is something you wanted to do, both being involved in the creative process behind the scenes and on camera.
Yes.
And that must have been a terrific journey for you.
Yeah.
And you're learning all the way, because you're a lifelong learner. That's clearly what you are.
Yes.
Now I hear that you are into the metaphysical stuff in terms of putting stuff out there and believing that it's going to go the right way. And there you can't be too attached to the outcome.
Yes.
And you want to go out and do the stuff that you already know you can do, but you want to keep taking it up a level.
Yes.
I mean, most people would settle.
Yeah.
Most people would be, you know what? I've had a good life as a comedian,
yes,
an actor, even a medical doctor. Maybe I should just stick with what I'm doing.
That's my demon.
Keep it going.
That's my demon.
Is that it?
That's my
demon. And I've got four kids to support.
Yeah, that's my demon. That's So my game plan is patience. But be like water. Be like water.
You're a really self-actualized human being.
You're a water, like I dropping and knocking through a rock. Right?
Dude.
Or flowing around the rock
but
to get to where I need to
be. This is a hugely introspective. I mean, you say you realized you don't know anything, but it sounds to me like you're one of those very rare 40-year-olds who kind of have figured out a lot. You're on your way to 80%.
I would like to talk about all of these things more in shows, but then what happens is you have your authentic voice. So that is what you're talking about, your authentic voice. And then jokes, and add you, jokes on.
Some of your audience aren't there to hear that stuff. No. They just want to, like, cheap laugh.
So this is my dilemma also. So you grow, like for example, this is how it worked out. We would be doing shows for everybody, right? Doing whatever stand-up. And then all of a sudden, we started doing one-man shows. Now, when I started doing one-man shows, all of a sudden, Muslim people started hanging out at my shows. This isn't a common Muslim activity. But now, all of a sudden, there's people like we would be like Taliban, like in my shows, right?
So now you're watching
so
yourself.
So now people, no, but people go like, this is weird.
Yeah,
now, for me,
weird.
I'm not necessarily watching myself. I'm just going,
expect the local imam to pop in for a comedy show.
Common, right? So then what happens is you talk about things that as a community you relate to. So what happens is a new genre of comedy emerges.
Uh-huh.
You start to do cultural jokes, you know? And then what happens is you get people start boxing you, right? Into this is the only
the
thing
Muslim
you start
comedian.
Speaking about,
yeah,
right? So... and then when I want
this
to...
This is the boxing I was talking
yes.
about. Yeah.
So then when you want to go, okay, now talk about other things. Or, like, I'm not a person who swears, right, generally. People will go, you know, you don't need to swear if you... Like, what I really like about your comedy is you don't swear and you don't really... Now, the irony is because I don't care.
Yeah.
It's just I don't swear as much.
It's like me with drugs. I'm not really that interested in them. Other people I know do them.
Yes.
It's not an exciting thing for me. I'm not curious about it. It's just something I've chosen not to do. Same thing for you
yes.
with swear.
So it's like, it's more like, if you go Flismas, like I love Flismas.
Mm.
I love Louis C.K., not the other things he does, but
not sure.
Well, I like, one of my favorite comics of recent years is Bill Burr, right?
Right.
Like, great, but the most profane things come out of his mouth.
Swearing
but I
the whole
love
time.
Love the authenticity of his humor. I love the structure of his jokes.
But that,
I love
that woman's voice you put on just now, he said, the swearing we love about Riyadh is he's clean. It's so patronizing in some way because that's not why you've chosen not to swear.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not your way of communicating.
Yeah.
And what irritates me about those people is that they're full of themselves. They're actually saying, I like what you're doing because it's what I do.
Yeah.
Again, it's this boxing, but it's in a different way.
Yes.
Because now, and this is where you get these, like Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld and all those guys saying, they don't want to do college campuses anymore because they get told by a bunch of people who don't know anything about the world that they're not allowed to say certain things or they're not allowed to find certain things funny.
Yes.
The thought police.
Yes.
These people who think they can creep into your head and say, all right, we've decided for your good that this is not funny anymore. And this idea of like you experienced that in a very proto way when you started, as you say, attracting like a Muslim community to shows that didn't normally go to shows. Because then you became the Muslim comedian.
Yes.
So the same people keep coming, but now they're expecting you to only joke about the Muslim community.
So for example, now when I went to go somewhere else, and even sometimes I use more like dark humor, right? They won't let me go there. Do you understand? So in a sense, from an artistic perspective, I'm held back. So because I can't be as honest as I want to be. So that's where the challenge is. So you can't always, you have to find your authentic outlet, which I think would be the comedy club and you know, express yourself there. And then you have a corporate manifestation when you do corporates, which is something else.
That's where you don't swear.
Yes, I've always had this, you know, they always come, usually stressed out person, event organizer with a folder.
Could we have a quick word?
Yes.
And just, you know what's coming.
Yes. And no black jokes, no white jokes, no Indian jokes, no political jokes.
No religious jokes.
No jokes,
swearing.
No jokes below the belt. No jokes about
and
belts.
Don't joke about the CEO.
Yes.
Because he's very touchy.
Yeah.
Even though he's the CEO of the company, he's got an ego that's as fragile as glass.
Yeah, you will laugh about it.
Yeah.
It's like no jokes with below the belt, no jokes about belts, no jokes with punchlines. But other than that, just go crazy.
Other than that, go crazy. We love you.
Yes.
And you're standing there with a mouthful of teeth and you're like,
But the benefit of that is that I like being able to perform everywhere. So when you do a comedy club, a lot of times you have younger people who don't know anything about the world,
mm-hmm.
right? But who are completely open.
Yes.
And then you got corporate audiences who know a lot about the world and politics, right?
But they're closed.
And then you got your theater crowds, which is usually more vibey. And it's your core fans, but who sometimes stop you from going where you actually want to be. And that comes from also it comes from the point of not wanting to fail. So you go at the very start, I was a comic who did well and I would be a headliner. Right, so now there's expectations. So every time I go on, I go at the end, and I got to kill.
Yeah,
because I'm the headliner for the night.
Oh, the pressure.
So the problem with that is, then you do it, but then you take less risks. So then there's less growth. So a person who takes more risks will grow quicker. That's just how.
This is why the guys keep going back to the comedy clubs. This is why you say that you identify with that.
Yes.
I'm amazed by the fact that you've taken in all of this stuff and that you take certain – I mean, I know that you probably are one of the comedians who really works hard on your material before you put it out there.
I've changed how I do it now. So, for example, I've changed that.
Yeah?
Because now I'm not making – I understand that the process of failure in doing what you do is more important than the like, so for Life Begins, I wrote it differently to the – other shows. Other shows I prepare. Like I'd write the script and I'd know, these are the jokes and I'll work out the thing. And
you didn't prepare this the same
no,
way?
No, no. This way is almost like it's as a result of my lifestyle in the sense that we're busy with the kids all the time and I'm freaking tired all the time. So what we put the beds kids to bed at around the beds. We put the kids to sleep around 8-ish, 7:30, 8-ish. And then usually because you're so tired, you fall asleep.
Yeah.
Right? So you wake up. I usually wake up a few minutes later. There's a line on my face, because you just I don't know where that line comes
from. The pillow.
From, right? I actually don't know
but
where that line comes
from. But you
have
to sleep.
From.
That line only comes from tired people sleeping.
And then saliva
coming out of you. Yeah.
Yes. I wipe my eyes. I get into the car, drive to the observatory, to the armchair theater, and talk on stage for 15 minutes.
To who?
At a show.
Okay. So you'd go up there.
There would be.
But you make it up.
I would have certain ideas. Ideas.
Does it make you nervous?
Yes.
Because you used to be able to
kind
of memorize certain
things. So I got to make sure that I'm okay with messing up. Because you got to... Because that's the sort of... in order for you to be create, you got to have that sort of comfort in order to risk it. You got to be able to risk it all. Like a lot of the best comedians, they do that. They risk things.
Is the payoff better when you try something and you're not sure if it's going to work and it works? Is that an incredible payoff? Or if you go with the standard regular, I know this is going to get laughs.
Yeah, I hate that now.
Really?
Now I hate that because I've done it before and I feel I'm not growing. So whereas you go you see how like for example, I was gonna move to New York, right, this year, but I can't because of the kids.
No,
because that would be a natural progression to do.
What were you gonna do? You even knew this last year when you're thinking about it. That'd be stupid. You have a 10-year-old and 8-year-old.
Yes, I did, and I was trying last year. I had
plus. What are the chances of a Muslim immigrant in New York under Trump? It's never going to happen. What are you, living on
crazy
a cloud?
But I was going to do
Jesus, why didn't you just phone me? I would have given you the short answer. What a dumb dream.
But you see, in order to grow, I have to be hanging around with the best comics.
Absolutely.
Right? Now, I had the opportunity to do some work, writing work with Trevor last
year. Yes.
He brought me over and I was assisting him with a project, right? Mm-hmm. And for example, now, like, we go, like, now, Trevor's one of those unusual people. In he has unnatural ability, right? He may not necessarily always have a hit song,
yeah,
but his innate ability is it's so, I always say it's like playing with Messi. Or
are you talking about his comedic ability? Or are you talking
his comedic ability and performance ability?
Okay,
like it's far beyond even what, in my view, what
just
like
describe to
Chappelle.
Me.
I'll explain to you what Chappelle, not Chappelle, maybe, but what Chris Rock and Seinfeld can do. Now, Seinfeld and Chris Rock, although they like the content that they come up with, like the song that they're gonna write is amazing, right? But the process to which they get that song, I understand. I go out on stage, I talk, I get laughs here, I get laughs there, nothing there, I refine, I do it again. I follow the process, and through that process, things become tighter and tighter and more refined.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Trevor can take material and assimilate it faster than anybody I've ever seen, and perform it perfectly quicker than anybody I've ever seen. So, for example, like I'm a good comic. And if you use the like a Messi analogy, I'll give you a great ball, right? But then you will take it and do something crazy with it, right? That is completely instinctual, right? And you can't, it's difficult to analyze.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Seinfeld, similar to me, my process with Seinfeld is very structured. And like my process with Seinfeld is similar. Because you see a Seinfeld that sits down certain times
it's
of
like
the
purifying
week.
A chemical.
He writes things and he distills things.
He's making nitrous oxide.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what he's doing.
That's perfect.
He's synthesizing nitrous oxide.
That's what he's doing.
And he's trying to get as pure a version of it as he can.
Yes.
And you're the same. And Trevor?
Trevor will just be able to, like for example, like if we're working on gags,
mm-hmm.
Trevor will be able to, working on a routine, so if there's a whole lot of jokes that are said first, he can flow with it and create something. But then he can also take that material and perform it perfectly with no ums, no ahs, with no preparation. A whole 10-minute, 15-minute piece with no preparation, perfectly, with confidently, with extreme poise. We used to think he used to start like practicing the toilet and like or somewhere
because he'd come out there immediately and hit
just
it.
Be able to and that
and
comes
hit the right
from,
notes.
Yes,
is it about reading people?
It's about I think it's about presence.
Huh.
So
is he like a zeitgeist machine?
He's like he's got an unusual ability, like unusual. He's an outlier. He's like so in America they haven't seen him necessarily also create a comedy special that where he's the content is actually he hasn't created his masterpiece yet. Like for example, like Michelangelo would but he's got that ability.
So we're going to wait for him to create that masterpiece. But in the meantime,
if he churns out things, may not. But if he cultivates space and
I see what you mean. He needs to actually create a room in order to develop this stuff because it requires a huge amount of introspection and selfish alone time and that kind of thing.
But now he's just like a dude.
He's churning.
His ability.
And he's doing that great. Let's not say there's anything
amazingly
wrong with that. But this masterpiece that you're talking about, I can totally see this now. It's like those great artists who they in one thing in their life that sets them apart forever.
Yes.
As a genius.
Yes. Yes.
But you've already seen that in him.
No. Like, I mean, his ability is insane. It's insane. Like, I don't know how he does this stuff.
Because when you started on, I mean, you were involved in the Pure Monate show. I was talking to Kagiso the other day about this.
Yeah.
And that show really was revolutionary.
Yeah.
What that show did for South Africa and what it did for comedy was probably looking back now, we can start to appreciate it for the first time in its context.
Yes.
Because at the time, you guys didn't know that it was going to be such
now,
a
cultural that came from Flow, do you understand?
This is the Flow that you're trying to get into now with these new shows.
Yeah, that came from Flow. So there's no, it came from within. So it's not like, oh, okay, we can make money from this, therefore we need to get into comedy.
No.
And therefore we're doing that. That comes, why is me as a medical doctor from Cape Town at UCT studying medicine, and David Kau and Kagiso, people from Kroonstad, coming from Pretoria, coming to Cape Town to study drama, gravitating towards the same thing. Why do we have this strange thing that is similar in all comedians within us? This weird thing that's off, you know, this requirement to stand on stage. Because a lot of funny people, but it's different to stand on stage and tell jokes.
You have to have a bit of an need to be punished.
I don't know what it
is. Like it's a little masochistic.
It's crazy. Mm. Why? And then you just join together and you create something where there's no guidance, but results in like people's careers skyrocket. It's like so many people.
That show, seminal.
Yeah. So you go like certain things when you watch it, this is genius. How do we ever come up with this? And other things you go, oh, what? Oh, my goodness.
Are there any things you've done in your comedy career that you're embarrassed about?
Many things.
Really? Do they bother you or are you able to let go?
I don't I didn't like my time on Laugh Out Loud. With a prank show.
Yeah. You weren't pleased with that.
I really
hated it. If you look back now, you're embarrassed.
I hated it.
Hey, we've all got them.
I hated it because also the comedy was like, it was insult comedy. So, for example, where you close the person off. Like, we do jokes where you make a joke and somebody makes a joke on top of a joke and other people make a joke on top of a joke, so you bolt.
Right.
Whereas that humor was you make a joke and then, like, somebody would make fun, oh, that's not a funny joke. And then you get a laugh, but then everything ends.
Yeah, it's that kind of comedy's dead.
Yeah, it's like it was just not cool for me. And but I mean, I think it's important that you have to do these things.
Can we talk about this Katrada portrayal? Because I mentioned earlier that I somehow get the idea that you were thinking about this 24/7 while you were in the role, and that you were trying to speak to him as much as you could. And luckily for you, your character was still alive at the time, even though he was, you know, significantly older.
Mm.
And he didn't really like talking about much of that stuff. Mm. He preferred to talk about the here and now and the future and all of that kind of thing. But what sort of research did you do?
I read a lot. So, like, I really, and I tried to even, like, embody the role. I was going about method during the time. So I would talk like Kathy and, you know, try and, be like him. The thing is, when you, beforehand, you would see the history as just words on a page. But now when you're an actor, you have to emotionally connect what happened. And you have to feel what they felt. So before you go, oh, so the biggest thing for me is that they were prepared to die. Because there was a certain point with the Rivonia trial, they were going to give a verdict. And they had a meeting before the verdict and they said, okay, now if this comes back, what are we going to do? Because by virtue of the law, they had leave to appeal, right? To appeal the death sentence. So they had a meeting. All of them says, okay, if we get the death penalty, are we going to appeal? So they said, we're not going to appeal if we get the death penalty because then you'd lose the impact. So they all decided collectively that if they're going to die, they're going to die. They're not going to follow the legal process like you see some people following now.
Even. Over and over again, yeah.
Okay, we're going to try and do the right thing, right, for the movement and truly sacrifice. So when also people talk about, you know, selling out in inverted commas these days and what happened at Godessa and all these things that are coming out now, They're not looking at the reality. They're looking at it if it was now.
It's even simpler than that. They don't read at all. And they have never bothered to learn the history.
Yes.
They're just taking their own experience and projecting what they think it should be based on this utopian idea that back in those days, those guys had all these options.
Well, there was no options. Like, no. I mean, at that point...
Their options in this situation you're talking about, their option was to appeal and actually become a part of the process of apartheid South Africa's legal system.
Yes.
Or to decide to die.
Yes. And then, you know, through that creating political impact, which will spur on more change and move the movement project the movement forward. So all of those things, and when you just like delve into the emotion of it, it is very, very eye-opening for me. And it was a life-altering experience.
How much time did you get to spend with him?
With Kathy, I was fortunate to spend a lot of time with him. And the saddest thing for me is that he loved kids so much and he never got to have kids. He was always Uncle Kathy also. So a lot of times he would be taking even Madiba's kids, Walter Sisulu's kids, all of them around, dropping them at school and so on.
Yeah.
As well, sometimes having to take them to Swaziland. I remember one of the stories where they went for schooling. And he always wanted kids. But the others, Madiba and Tambo and Sisulu, they had their children because they were older. Right? He never had kids. And when you're in prison, right, you aren't allowed access. There's no kids.
Yeah,
and
that's why they all love kids. So
yeah, they all talk about that because you live in an unnatural society, so you get exposed to.
Well, there are no women and there are no children.
No women, but women you can see at visits.
Yeah,
but kids, you even their own kids can only be seen when they're 16.
Yes.
So Kathy said it was like there was 22 years that he hadn't seen a child, and he saw a child unexpectedly. His lawyer. It was in Polsmoor, which is slightly more relaxed
than Robben Island.
His lawyer came to see him for one of the visits, and I think it was on Eid, he said. And because it was in Polsmoor, there was no glasses. It was just a room. They would meet together. And the lawyer had brought his daughter with. And for some reason, the warders allowed her in. And so all of a sudden, he expected to have this meeting, and all of a sudden, here's his lawyer with a little girl, Priya, who is now his goddaughter, and he was completely mesmerized. He spent the whole time talking to her and chatting to her. And when he went back to his cell, he couldn't think. He couldn't let go of the experience that, because they start to along for the cry of a child, let alone the laughter, because it's like you only exposed to certain groups of people, white men in warders' uniforms, black men in prisoners' uniform, women you see at visits. So, and when I saw this interview, because I just had my, like, I think it was my second one, right? And as of when you have kids and you get a bit old, you become more emotional. Men become more emotional, right? And I just saw his eyes, man. And I was in a plane, right? And he's saying this, and all of a sudden, I couldn't stop. I got emotional. I was like, I couldn't stop crying, and it was very embarrassing to me because I'm sitting like in between people. I don't know if it was a mango, right? And like I'm like just trying.
You're wailing.
To keep this. Yeah, like really, it just knocked me. And it was always liked hanging around with, like, playing with Mike and my kids and all of that. So
that's amazing.
This was a sad thing, but I mean, he was always very inspirational person, and I haven't spoken to Barbara about how he felt at the end. Because at that point, things were quite hard.
Yeah, he died right in the middle of probably the biggest trough in our graph for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly since he came out of jail.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know how he felt. But
maybe he'd feel better now.
Yeah, maybe. I think I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? Let's not get into it. I see the one thing I'm actually bored talking about is politics, because there's so much amateur politics going on.
So now it's actually politics.
Yeah.
But then there was
a threat to society kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he was one of the few people who did stand up and say something, even though he was a, an advanced age, and he had this huge reputation, and he had credentials.
Yes. And he was never on boards.
No.
Yeah.
He was clean.
He was clean. He was never, like, they asked him to sit on boards. No. You just, you know, write. You would show people around Robben Island.
These people who say that they were all sellouts, those guys.
Yeah.
They irritate you. I can
tell. And they
tell.
Irritated him. He called them the peacetime protesters.
Yeah, struggle. It's called struggle envy.
Yeah, he said he would never, like, say this publicly, but the peacetime protesters.
Well, now you can say it on his
behalf. I don't
know. So, he wouldn't have minded. And he liked your portrayal.
Yeah, he liked it. Yeah,
that's nice to also get that feedback from someone, because I think he's a hero, and for him to say that. For your portrayal.
The weird thing is
that's a big deal.
They wanted us to sound more less South African for the show.
Ugh.
Because of the accent. We speak quite flat.
Goddamn producers.
Yeah, so the director was like, we had to spend a lot of time with Mr. Cathrada, but your accent can't be so strong. Right, you need to just tone it down a little bit. We've got this dialect coach working with, and then let me hear how you're going to do it. And I'm like, hello. My name is Ahmed Cathrada. It's too much, mate. You don't go rrr, go rrr, go just round it off. Just
so you have to learn a different accent.
I was like, hello, my name is Ahmed Cathrada. It's still too much. And I'm like, I didn't know what I'm supposed to do. I'm going, hello, my name is Ahmed Cathrada.
I'll say it like you, Mr.
Ill
Director.
Bean. This is my compatriot, Nelson Rory, Mandela.
Irritating.
He's probably like, that's amazing. Just do it just like, that's perfect. So, yeah.
All right. So, life begins.
Yeah. Life begins. It's happening at...
I've got the D. Let me do this. Let me earn my keep here. Life begins. Auto and General Theatre on the Square in Sandton, 27 March to 7 April 2018. We'll probably be sold out in the next couple of hours. So,
yeah.
Get in there while you can.
Hopefully.
Yeah. I didn't know this about you, but you failed your first chemistry test.
Yes, dude.
You know, I love chemistry.
Yes, and I did well at school.
Yeah, but you were a doctor and...
No,
and
chemistry first year.
Yeah, but you also...
UCT,
you did magic. You did magic. Yes, you should have known how to do chemistry.
Yeah.
What's wrong with you?
I don't know.
What was it? What
I sat there at that, like, in Jamison Wall. I remember those birds. They were tormenting me. Like,
telling you how stupid you were.
I was like, how do I not know what's going on here? You know, my worst. It's like I think I just now got knocked with university, difficulty immediately. And, you know, I adjusted.
Of all the things to fail, though, chemistry.
Chemistry.
You still
difficult,
do,
dude.
Do you still do any magic?
I try a little bit for my kids every now and then. And I think I will probably revisit it a little, maybe do some kids.
Are they impressed? You know?
Some of the tricks though, yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes. My kids, like, I mean, usually it's
because you got to keep practicing that stuff.
Yes.
You forget.
Yes.
The other thing
it is muscle memory. So I find myself, I like do these things with cards and I'm like, wow. There aren't many Indian magicians out there, right?
Why do you think that is?
They are. They're just not called magicians, accountants. That's what they call them. Make your taxable income disappear. So that's what they are. But there's not many. Like, dynamos coming. There's no, like, you know, I've never seen many Indian magicians.
But there are a lot of doctors in your family.
Yeah.
Your sister, father,
yeah.
Your mother.
My mother, yeah.
I mean, Jesus.
And my brother, who's now, who decided he's not going to do medicine because he hates blood, he's working in the hospital now.
You're joking.
Yeah, he studied
another one.
Actuarial science and finance. But my dad got involved in a hospital project. So now he's.
Were they originally, when you started doing the comedy stuff, were they pleased or were they annoyed about this? Because you were on a path to certain security and success.
I slipped it in. It was like. Because I never said I'm gonna. There was never a fight.
Because in the movie material, right? Yeah. I mean, I saw you doing that role, and I saw you living out some of your own life there.
Yeah, but not
personally. To that degree.
That was more a dramatization of the cultural pressure.
Yeah.
From my family, it wasn't there. So you, because I wouldn't. There was no moment where I confronted my parents, Mom, Dad, I just want to be funny, and then I'm going to Johannesburg, and I'm living my car, I'm going to do stand up. There's never, and I don't know why I put on that accent for some reason. For some reason, I had a Model C accent. Right, I went to a colored school. Right?
Grassy Park, right?
Grassy Park in primary school and Fairview in primary school, primary school and South Peninsula in high school. We always talk about like the type of schools where the cricket field, the assembly area, the volleyball court, the same gravel tarmac, when you do practical chemistry is like reading.
Same area as well.
No, it's no practical. There's no stuff.
Oh, right. So there's
we're
no laboratories.
Chemistry prac, and you imagine,
no wonder you failed chemistry.
Yeah, you visualize.
You never saw the stuff.
It's burning magenta.
You're trying to picture it. It's an imagination class.
Yeah. So that's what it was like.
Listen, dude, I love catching up with you. We've got to do this again. We've got to do it more often. I'm glad we got to talk a little bit about the show and about your movies. But there's so much more that we still have to cover. And actually, I hope Trevor gets to hear how complimentary you were about his preternatural abilities.
No, I tell him all the time.
Yeah, this is great. But it's good to see you.
Thank you.
Keep well, Riyadh. Nice to see you again. Riyadh Musa, everybody.
This is CliffCentral.com.